Five centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
The theme of this series is Two Cities, Two Loves. And our hosts are the Reverend Ken Jones, pastor of Greater Union Baptist Church in Compton, California, Dr. Rod Rosenblatt, a Lutheran minister and professor at Concordia University in Irvine, Dr. Kim Riddlebarger, who's pastor of Christ Reformed Church in Anaheim, California, and I'm Mike Horton. I teach at Westminster Seminary in California. You know, people, it seems, are today really ready for the Christian teaching that while there can be tremendous gains in social improvement and cultural strides, salvation isn't something we believe we can achieve through humanity, brotherhood, or the isms of the left and the right. The Russian literary dissident Alexander Solzhenitsyn told a Harvard audience, "We have placed too much hope in politics and social reforms only to find out that we were being deprived of our most precious possession, our spiritual life. It's trampled by the party mob in the East and by the commercial mob in the West." Poignantly framing this postmodern sentiment is Sting's "If I Ever Lose My Faith in You." You could say I lost my faith in science and progress. You could say I lost my belief in the Holy Church. You could say I lost my sense of direction, he says. And then the refrain brings Sting back to the woman in his life. "If I ever lose my faith in you, there'd be nothing left for me to do." Again, he says, "Some would say that I was a lost man in a lost world. You could say I lost my faith in the people on TV. You could say I lost my belief in the politicians. They all seem like game show hosts to me." And then the song closes with this verse. "I never saw no miracle of science that didn't go from a blessing to a curse. I never saw no military solution that didn't always end up as something worse. But let me say this first, if I ever lose my faith in you, there'd be nothing left for me to do." And in that same song, he says, "I've lost my faith in the Holy Church." Just at the point when the culture is most ready to hear our story for the first time in a while, we're caught up in the very crusade mentality that people, conservatives and liberals, resent. The question is, will we be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks us to give the reason for the hope that we have? Or will we continue to be so caught up in moral and political solutions to this deep spiritual crisis that we end up, ironically, actually deepening the crisis? In this program, part three of a six-part series, we're going to take a look at our tactical mistakes in the culture war and those assumptions that underlie them. Guys, when we talk about the tactical mistakes in the cultural war, one of them, I think, is humanism. This attack on humanism. J.I. Packer and Thomas Howard wrote a good book years ago, Christianity, the True Humanism.
That's an excellent book.
Humanism isn't necessarily man at the center of existence. But if it were, then many of the people who berate the culture for its quote-unquote humanism don't seem to have a problem preaching it from their pulpits on Sunday morning.
Well, you can take that back. Charles Finney, for Pete's sake. Yeah. Finney, the father of American revivalism, of course, was a thoroughgoing Pelagian and decried the dependence of Reformation Christians upon the supernatural for a revival. If that's not humanism, I don't know what is.
Isn't one of the problems, too, with this assumption that, I mean, you hear it all the time in terms of the cultural elite, this sustained attack on the cultural elite, which sort of gives the impression that we're the cultural backwater. And in a lot of cases, that is true, because the evangelical movement is so enamored of popular culture that can you think of the last evangelical who was the president of the Smithsonian?
Sure.
Or who was...
Sure.
An editor of The New Yorker. You just can't think of those people because they're not there. Evangelicals don't value, because of their cultural prejudices, don't value the culture. And so they're not taken seriously by the culture when they can dismiss as the focus of evil in the world the cultural elites.
Yeah, Kim, sometimes I appreciate when you come in defense on some things. On this one, I'd like to. I think that many of the evangelicals have felt down deep in their gut the disenfranchisement of their family, values, and everything else as America has gone. And so it comes out in ways like this. Those people back in Boston who da-da-da-da.
It's frustration.
It's frustration, but I can understand part of it, that they are pretty sure that they're in line with something that had a lot to do with what defined this country in prior era, and that no longer is that respected. And so there's a frustration.
Right, right. There's a disconnect, and they don't know what to do about it.
Yeah, and they're not quite sure what to do, so you go into a culture war to try and get it back again.
Right. Mm. I think it's very understandable.
Yeah.
But doesn't it help to set up this disastrous situation in which, for instance, whole denominations can boycott Disney and pour all kinds of energy into that because, after all, popular entertainment and popular culture is what's important. I think there are a lot of evangelical brothers and sisters who would just let their children watch endless television as long as it was morally uplifting.
Right.
Well, Rod's point is well taken, that out of a sense of frustration, Christians tend to polarize into a kind of a culture war type mentality. But what they also do is create an evangelical subculture as an alternative to secular culture.
Right. Yeah.
And the evangelical subculture is thoroughly moralistic. It is every bit as worldly, if not more so, than the culture that they're reacting against. That's your point, Mike. How many Christians stick their kids in front of a Christian video that teaches them that basically the gospel is being a better person and helping your mom with the chores and, you know, that kind of stuff, this moralistic crud that passes for content? So it's a real issue.
But now, going back to something that Rod talked about, when you look at the culture wars and people, say, for instance, in the Midwest, see the shifting and changing of values and they attribute it to the thought process that's generated in the East. Okay, now that's a real cultural war. Now, I'm wondering if what we're calling a cultural war is both cultural and religious. It's not one or the other. It's a merging of the two. Now, Mike, when you mentioned the whole Disneyland thing, this is not just a clash of values. But when we talk about how it's affected evangelicals, it's a clash of values as well as a source of authority. The church, many evangelicals are looking to the culture as a source of authority and guidance because of something that's lacking within the church. So I think we have to look at the distinction of what's taking place within the church as well as in the culture, because you are involved in a culture war whether you're a Christian or not.
Yeah.
Right. Well, and then you've got the furthering complicating factors, the decline of regional culture. Mm-hmm. Everything becoming pop culture. No highbrow, no lowbrow, now no brow, as John Seabrook has written. Mm-hmm. You've got that on top of everything else, where the distinctions between high class, low class, those things are gone now. Everything is pop culture. Mm-hmm. And so Christians find themselves in a swirl of pop culture, and Disneyland is an icon of pop culture.
Right.
And the church, the whole church growth movement, as we talked about in prior series, all of that tends to follow in lockstep and say that it's all pop. It all has to be driven by pop culture.
I think if somebody were to say to us, well, can you give me some sort of recommendations along this line? This is really overwhelming, or it's so broad, it's like sword fighting with a fog. Where can I begin? And the first thing I think of is the education of the youth. I don't think it's by accident. Mark said, give me your youth up until they're age 8, and then you can have them back and you can do whatever you want. How we do that, I don't know, but I think that's one that's really worth thinking about. How can a Christian couple have an education for their children that's really worth them having?
Yeah.
And I'm not thinking here primarily of religion. I'm thinking primarily in terms of whether they can read and whether they can do algebra and whether they recognize the great names of the past and so forth. That's something that I think it really, if you're talking about a tremendous amount of energy that the evangelical has put into fighting this fight in ways that probably are not the wisest. Here's something, if we could have an alternative of some kind that really would, where the sons and daughters of Reformed and Lutheran families were educated people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Boy.
And, you know, that's the kind of culture that there was largely. We can be very critical of the civil religion of the Protestant establishment in America. But one of the points, I mentioned this interview last week, David Brooks, his new book, Bobos in Paradise, it's on the boomer culture. And one of the points that he makes, though himself a secular Jew, he says the Protestant establishment in America, you know, the Calvinists who founded Harvard, Yale, mm-hmm. Dartmouth, Princeton, and who built hospitals, and the Reformed and Lutheran churches that had their own schools and yep. so forth. He says this Protestant establishment, with for all of its problems, had built into it a sense of obligation
mm-hmm.
that the boomers with sometimes double the wealth mm-hmm. don't have.
Right.
And one of the points he makes there is that it used to be the case that people who were theologically trained and catechized did have more of a sense of obligation as citizens,
mm-hmm.
whereas today there really is very little sense of being obligated to anything or anyone but oneself.
Well, that gets back to Ken's points. It's the loss of authority in the church. Mm-hmm. I mean, Christians have got to go back to their own roots and begin to be very, very clear about the distinction between the two kingdoms, about the distinction between law and gospel. We have to catechize Rod not only with the youth, but we've got to start where we are, make sure our own people have these categories down so that they have some kind of an intellectual grid to help them from following lockstep with the culture, not knowing what to do. Christians know that boycotting Disneyland's not going to do any good, mm-hmm. but they don't know what else to do.
Right, exactly.
And we've got to give them something right. else to do by giving them the classical Reformation categories. It starts with the church catechizing.
Right.
I don't know about your side of the street, but on ours, one of the ones, I'll just say this very short and leave it. One of the ones that I would like to see happen on our side in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, we have the largest parochial school system other than Rome in America. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to see us saying, how exactly is what you get at your parochial school different or better from what you get at the local public school?
Mm-hmm.
And by that, I don't mean an addition of 30 seconds or 4 minutes on Luther's catechism.
Or praying before class.
Or praying before class. Exactly.
Or moralistic curricula.
That's right. That's right. And that's something within the Christian church, at least in my world, that could have just tremendous effect. And it would be a great start.
Well, my kids go to a Reformed school made up of several Reformed denominations, and the danger we have there is the chapels are all Schwermerei chapels.
Sure.
It's utterly Pentecostal.
Sure.
Another myth is that American culture is a Judeo-Christian monolith.
Hardly.
Right. And not only today. I mean, the picture here is they have taken, in fact, a book was written a number of years ago, The Stealing of America, as if it belonged to me. This is a charge of theft. People have stolen the country from the people who rightfully own it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, number one, that it isn't that disastrous for evangelism, because now we're talking about reaching out to an incredibly diverse, ethnically diverse, religiously diverse culture, basically telling them not that they are excluded from the kingdom of God at present because they haven't received Christ, but that they are excluded, or should be excluded at least, from the political process
mm-hmm.
because this land is our land
uh-huh.
and not necessarily your land.
Mm-hmm.
We were here first, and of course, if you want to play that game,
yeah.
give it to the Native Americans.
Well, it's kind of hard in terms of evangelism to tell people that you came over, by the way, and you took their country, and now you're going to evangelize them. It's yeah. kind of hard to tell them that
it's going to hurt you more than it'll hurt me.
Yeah, yeah, that we're all in this together, and it's kind of hard
right.
to say with much credibility
right.
this is ours, and especially if you are excluding the people that were here prior and not calling human the people that are helping you work the land which you stole from another country. I mean, it's kind of hard to gain any sense of social and theological credibility in cases like that.
In fact, it really is important for us to realize that there were two streams in the emergence of the American democracy. There was the pagan stream, which was largely through the French Revolution, and Thomas Jefferson and Thomas Paine were very much influenced by that. Then there was the Reformation influence, and the embers were burning pretty low by the time of the American Revolution on that one. So already by 1776, It was a pretty secular country. People don't like to face that. But at the time of the founding of the country, I think it was 6% of the colonists were churched. 6%. Today it's like 85%. And here are some interesting things that you're probably not likely to hear from Christian America folks. Sounding in retrospect almost like a flower child of the 60s, John Adams chanted, "Let the human mind loose. It must be loose. It will be loose. Superstition and dogmatism cannot confine it." And Adams thought it ridiculous that people like John Quincy would still believe in the Trinity and the deity of Christ. An evangelical parent might complain to the public school board these days that her son's teacher refers to God as the Force or the World Spirit, calling on the founding fathers for support. But she won't find much support in 1776, as the infinite personal God of Scripture was traded in by many of the founding fathers for a universal governor, benign providence. George Washington used that kind of language.
Mm-hmm. Lincoln's language is that stuff.
Absolutely. Transcendentalist. Yeah. Gary Will's book, Lincoln and Gettysburg, makes the great case that Lincoln draws on those same two streams. The Biblicist tradition only mediated through the Transcendentalists, and then the Greek rhetorical tradition.
Yeah.
And so America's always been a melting pot, and intellectually a melting pot.
For Jefferson, religion served a purpose only so long as it remained nothing more than a system of morality. You know his famous Bible where he cut out all the references to the miraculous.
You literally can see that still, can't you? Isn't that on display?
Library of Congress. Jefferson, as for the Judeo part of the Judeo-Christian, Jefferson said that the attributes of the Jewish God were, quote, degrading and injurious to morality, and not only imperfect, but often irreconcilable with the sound dictates of our reason. But the New Testament didn't get much better review because the disciples were, quote, the most unlettered and ignorant of men on the earth. Jesus' teachings found in the Bible are mutilated, misstated, and often unintelligible. I not only write nothing on religion, said Jefferson, but rarely permit myself to speak on it, and never but in reasonable company.
Good grief.
And he referred to the doctrines of the Trinity, the deity of Christ, resurrection, as impious heresies.
Yeah, I think most Jewish Americans would be surprised to hear that Judeo-Christian ethics are at the foundation of this country.
Well, not only is there historical debate about that, and I think we need to talk about this again because, you know, as Mike points out, there are many streams here. And one of those streams is a number of our founding fathers looked to Calvin and Lex Rex and all the other texts to draw on that. Sure. Where the church goes wrong in this is in the face of this, as Rod points out, this fear that we're losing what was rightfully ours in a church full of parents with kids and not knowing what to do. Mm-hmm. The worst thing that can happen is when a minister gets in his pulpit, as one of our guys did on the Sunday before the 4th of July, and his sermon was on George Washington, the very next Sunday to celebrate the celebration of the past weekend. He was talking This is a certain
pastor?
Television preacher talking about the national debt from John chapter 3. Now, that is the worst of all possible responses for a Christian, especially a Reformed Christian.
But what's really interesting is if Coffin does it, left-wing Vietnam preacher, if he does that with a text like that, then it's liberalism.
Yep. Right. Yeah, absolutely.
But if we do it, it's okay because it's conservative politics. Yeah. You can just bury the Bible all you want and forget God. He can go take a flying leap.
Yep.
Just as long as it's conservative politics.
Yeah. Well, a Christian minister has no right to mention George Washington in a sermon, much less devote an entire hour of God's time to American history.
Yeah. Sure.
But Mike, you make a very important point, I think one that we are careless in overlooking. When we talk about the founding fathers, we're not talking about the establishment of this country. We're talking about the establishment of the government of this country. Pilgrims came here in the 17th century. The American Revolution was fought in the 18th century. And so the strongest theological influence that would draw from the Reformation would be found really in between 1620, in the 1620s up until the early 1700s, at which time there is a definite definite theological and intellectual shift.
Right. There really was. Arminianism first took over at the Ivy League schools, founded by Calvinists.
Mm-hmm.
And then Unitarianism very quickly spread. But you're right. What's interesting is places like Harvard and Yale and Princeton were founded, first of all, to train ministers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The University of Virginia, by contrast, founded by Jefferson, refused to appoint any faculty members in theology, following the radical rationalism of the Enlightenment in its belief that theology just gets in the way of education and civility. And in fact, he saw his new university as a place where students would be freed from religion and traditions and what he regarded as superstition, we just would regard as supernatural Christianity. In correspondence with Jefferson, John Adams frankly expressed his disdain for classical Christianity, particularly its doctrine of miracles, the deity of Christ, the necessity of supernatural redemption, and a final judgment. Other than that, he was fairly committed Christian. He writes to Jefferson, quote, this is John Adams, "My adoration of the author of the universe is too profound and too sincere. The love of God and his creation, delight, joy, triumph, exultation in my own existence, though but an atom, a molecule organic in the universe, these are my religion. Howl, snarl, bite, ye Calvinistic, ye Athanasian divines, if you will. Ye will say I am no Christian. I say ye are no Christians, and there the account is balanced." And Jefferson responds, quote, "I join you, therefore, in sincere congratulations that this den of the priesthood," talking about the New England clergy, "this den of the priesthood is at length broken up now, and that a Protestant popedom is no longer to disgrace the American history and character. Concurring with Adams that if by religion people meant doctrines, particularly Orthodox Christian ones, quote, this would be the best of all possible worlds if there were no religion in it."
Oof.
So it's a mixed bag, folks. There were people like John Witherspoon, who was a staunch Christian, Patrick Henry. There were many Christians, but this is a mixed bag. This nation never has belonged to us, and no nation, even if it were founded as a Christian nation, belongs to us, because even you would think that the patriarchs of the Old Testament would be looking forward to the earthly plot of land in Jerusalem. If there was any land that you could say was a Christian nation or a God's chosen nation, it would be there. And yet we read that they were looking for a better city, one whose builder and maker was God.
And looking at it from a different angle, I think one can even see providence in the fact that the congregation was so divided between the Paines and Jeffersons and all the deists and the Reformation believers. There was a certain providence in that, such that I'm not hanged at dawn for holding the wrong religious position.
Absolutely.
For instance, on the Lord's Supper.
Right.
Oh!
Well, on that note, we will take our hit and run. We will look forward to being with you next week on The White Horse Inn.
The White Horse Inn is a listener-supported broadcast. For more information about supporting our efforts, give us a call at 1-800-890-7556. That's 1-800-890-7556. You can also visit us online at whitehorsein.org. That's whitehorsein.org.